potential impact of cognitive functioning, and it only adds to the growing list of reasons why climate change requires rather urgent action. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. Dogs spontaneously process basic numerical quantities using a distinct part of their brain that corresponds very closely to the number-responsive neural regions in human beings, finds a study at Emory University. Biology Letters published the results, which suggest that a common neural mechanism has been deeply conserved across mammalian evolutionary lines. Quote, our work not only shows that dogs use a similar part of their brain to process numbers of objects as humans do, it shows that they don't need to be trained to do it, said Gregory Burns, Emory professor of psychology and senior author of this study. Understanding neural mechanisms, both in humans and across species, gives us insight into both how our brains evolved over time and how they function now, says co-author Stella Lorenko, a associate professor of psychology at Emory. Such insights, Lorenko adds, may one day lead to practical applications such as treating brain abnormalities and improving artificial intelligence systems. The study used functional magnetic resonance imaging to scan dogs' brains as they viewed varying number of dots flashed on a screen. The results showed that the dogs' parietal-temporal cortex responded to differences in the number of dots. The researchers held the total area of the dots constant, demonstrating that it was the number of dots and not the size that generated that response. The approximate number system supports the ability to rapidly estimate a quantity of objects in a scene, such as the number of predators approaching or the amount of food available for foraging. Evidence suggests that humans primarily draw on their parietal cortex for this ability as well, which is present even in infancy. The basic sensitivity to numerical information, known as numerosity, does not rely on symbolic thought or training and appears to be widespread throughout the animal kingdom. Much of the research in non-humans, however, has involved intensive training of the subject. Previous research, for example, has found that particular neurons in the parietal cortex of monkeys are attuned to numerical values. Such studies has not clarified whether numerosity is a spontaneous system in non-human primates because the subjects underwent many trials and received rewards for selecting scenes with greater numbers of dots in preparation for the experiment. Let me drop for a second. Behavioral studies in dogs that were trained in the task of discriminating between different quantities of objects have also indicated that dogs are sensitive to numerosity. The Emory researchers wanted to delve further into the neural underpinnings of canine number perception using functional MRIs. Burns is a founder of the Dog Project, which is researching evolutionary questions surrounding man's best oldest friend. The project was the first to train dogs to voluntarily enter an FM, a functional magnetic resonance imaging scanner, and remain motionless during the scanning without restraints or sedation. 11 dogs of varying breeds were involved in the current functional MRI experiment. The dogs did not receive advanced training in numerosity. After entering the functional MRI, they passively viewed dot arrays that varied in numerical value. 8 of the 11 dogs showed greater activation in the parietal-temporal cortex than the ratio between alternating dot arrays was more dissimilar than when the numerical values were held constant. Quote, we went right to the source, observing the dog's brain to get a direct understanding of what their neurons were doing when the dogs viewed varying quantities of dots, Olis said. That allows us to bypass the weaknesses of previous behavioral studies of dogs and some other species. Humans and dogs are separated by 80 million years of evolution, Burns notes. Our results provide some of the strongest evidence yet that numerosity is a shared neural mechanism that goes back at least that far, he said. Unlike dogs and other animals, humans are able to build on basic numerosity in order to do more complex math, drawing primarily on the prefrontal cortex. A part of the reason that we are able to do calculus and algebra is because we have this fundamental ability for numerosity that we share with other animals, Olis said. I'm interested in learning how we evolve that higher math ability, how these skills develop over time in individuals, starting with basic numerosity in infancy. Let me drop any questions or comments. This is AC2's Yes. Okay, on with the next. In the course of conducting solar astronomy, scientists have noticed that periodically the sun's tangled magnetic field lines will snap and then realign. This process is known as magnetic reconnection, where the magnetic topology of a body is rearranged and the magnetic energy is converted into kinetic energy, thermal energy, and particle acceleration. However, while observing the sun, a team of Indian astronomers recently witnessed something unprecedented. A magnetic reconnection that was triggered by a nearby eruption. This observation has confirmed a decade-old theory about magnetic reconnection and external drivers that could also lead to a revolution in our understanding of space weather and controlled fusion and plasma experiments. Using data from NASA's Solar Dynamic Observatory, researchers observed a magnetic explosion unlike any other. It began in the upper reaches of the sun's atmosphere, the corona, where a large loop of material, a prominence, was launched by an eruption from the sun's surface. The loop then began descending back to the surface and then ran into a mass of entangled field lines, triggering a magnetic explosion. Quote, this was the first observation of an external driver of magnetic reconnection. This could be very useful for understanding other systems, for example, Earth's planetary magnetosphere, other magnetized plasma sources, including experiments at laboratory scales where plasma is highly diffusive and very hard to control. In previous cases, magnetic reconnections that were observed on both the Sun and around Earth had been spontaneous in nature. These occur only when conditions are just right in a particular region of the Sun, which includes a thin sheet of ionized gas, such as plasma, that only conducts electric current, but only weakly. Let me drop for a second. While the possibility of forced reconnections driven by explosions was first theorized 15 years ago, none had ever been seen directly. This type of reconnection can happen in a wider range of places where plasma sheets have even lower resistance to conducting electric current. However, it also requires an eruption to trigger it, which will squeeze the plasma and magnetic fields and cause them to reconnect. Using the Solar Dynamic Observatory, the team was able to study this plasma by examining the sun at a wavelength that showed particles heated to between 1 to 2 million degrees centigrade. That's 1.8 to 3.6 degrees Fahrenheit for you Fahrenheit fans. This allows them to observe and take images of a forced reconnection even in the solar corona for the first time in history. It began with the prominence in a corona falling back into the photosphere, where it ran into a mess of field lines and reconnected in a distinctive X shape. Magnetic reconnection offers a possible explanation of why the sun's corona is actually millions of degrees hotter than the lower atmosphere, which has been an enduring mystery for astronomers. To address this, solar scientists have spent decades looking for a possible mechanism that could be responsible for driving this heat. With this in mind, the researchers observed the plasma in multiple ultraviolet wavelengths to calculate its temperature after the reconnection event. The data shows that the prominence, which was cooler than the surrounding corona, became hotter after the reconnection event. This suggests that forced reconnection could be responsible for heating the corona locally. Let me drop for a sec. While spontaneous reconnection could still be a contributing factor, forced reconnections appear to be a bigger one, capable of raising plasma temperatures faster, higher, and in a more controlled fashion. In the meantime, researchers will continue to look for more forced reconnection events in the hopes of better understanding the mechanism behind them and how often they might occur. These results could also lead to the additional solar research to see if eruption events like flares and coronal mass ejection could also cause forced reconnection. Since these eruptions are the driving force behind space weather, which can wreak havoc on satellites and electronic infrastructure here on Earth, further research into forced reconnections could help lead to better predictive models. These, in turn, would allow for early warning and preemptive measures to be taken in the event of a flare or ejection. Understanding how magnetic connections can be forced by an external driver could also lead to breakthroughs in the lab. This is particularly true of fusion experiments, where scientists are working to figure out how to control streams of superheated plasma. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS.
WS2N.
Yes, Paul.
Maybe about a half a dozen years ago, they sent up four satellites at one time in Earth orbit, and they were called the Magnetic Spherical Multiscale Mission, the MMS mission. And I think it was MMM. I'm trying to remember the designation that they had. It was on an Atlas V rocket, and they would follow one another in orbit, you know. It's a couple, maybe sometimes as close as 10 miles and sometimes maybe 100 miles. And they were studying this whole reconnection business in Earth's atmosphere. It was on highly elliptical orbits, so they were going through the Van Allen belts and all. I know they did a lot of studies on that, so that might relate to this topic to some degree.
Well, I think it does. I mean, that was some of the more initial research into the subject. I mean, actually, the TechNet has kind of brought up the question of why the surface of the sun isn't as hot as the corona above it. What's going on in that gap that superheats the corona? And we've talked about sound waves, and we've talked about magnetic reconnections. These studies kind of suggest for a forced reconnection of the magnetic field lines as a cause for these rapid increases in temperature.
You know, I was surprised to find out it's the reconnection of the magnetic, you know, when the magnetic field reconnects, that's what gives off a tremendous amount of energy. I always thought it was that when it's separated, you know, it's when it reconnects. And that's what I found out from this mission anyway. It was the magnetospheric multi-scale mission. And, you know, it was supposed to go for a couple of years. My guess is that, you know, the mission has probably ended. But, you know, it was like about 5 years ago, 5 or 6 years ago. But I know they did a lot of studies on it. And they felt by knowing what's going on here, you would find out these other locations, like you said, around the sun or other areas that have a strong magnetic field. But, you know, by knowing the Earth environment, they would know the other locations as well. And apparently it helps them understand the space weather to some degree.
Yeah, this all is helpful in producing more accurate modeling. You now know more of the variables and how they play into each other. You know, when the magnetic field lines, when they're broken, they have a higher potential energy level. They lose energy when they reconnect. That's kind of the thermodynamic reason why they tend to reconnect. And that energy, as we saw it before, is neither created nor destroyed, so it has to go someplace. So it gets converted from magnetic field energy into kinetic energy and the heat of the corona.
Okay. Yeah, I agree. As you were talking, I brought it up. Yeah, it was launched in, I guess, 2015. And it's still at it. Okay, so it's had some extended missions. And they say that it discovered the direct magnetic reconnection. That's the main discovery. Says it is a phenomenon that drives the space weather. Just brought this thing up. Ah, very good. Back to you, Bruce.
Yes, indeed. It's always good to get the information from these experiments. And the nature of experiments is that, you know, once they do their analysis, they don't put the data away. They bring it back every so often when someone has a clever idea of how to massage the data and run it through models and such. So I'm sure we're going to keep hearing about studies that are based partially, at least, on these data sets.
I'd like to see another mission dedicated to it, too. This one was very successful, but, I mean, they have even more sensitive instruments now that they could do even better, especially now that they've proven that they could do it. So, full information. They all launched on one rocket, and, they had their own little GPSs, so they would move close to one another and further apart, and as they were going, one would pick up the signal of a reconnection, and then as the other one came through, that would kind of confirm it. By having four of them like this, following one another, or in a pyramid fashion, they were able to really get accurate information on every one of these, break and reconnection of the magnetic field.
I'm sure there's newer technology that would give more information, and, you know, if NASA had a blank check, there would be all kinds of great research projects. There's a lot of very clever scientists and engineers all over NASA that come up with great ideas, but there's only so many dollars in the budget, and they have to kind of put them to areas that they feel will give the most benefit. Gone are the good old days of the Apollo program, where they could kind of write their own checks almost. Nowadays, things are very, very tight, and the Congress watches them like hawks. So I wish them well. I always think more knowledge is always better than less knowledge.
Okay, I'll let you continue. I'm reading through the instruments that they had. So go ahead, I'll write back to you.
Okay, on to a biological subject. A devastating disease spreading from China has wiped out roughly one quarter of the world's pigs, reshaping farming and hitting the diets and pocketbooks of consumers around the globe. China's unsuccessful effort to stop the disease may have hastened the spread, creating problems that could bedevil pig and global agriculture for years to come. To halt African swine fever, as the disease is called, the authorities must persuade farmers to kill infected pigs and dispose of them properly. But in China, officials have been frugal to the point of stingy, requiring farmers to jump through hoops to seek compensation from often cash-poor local governments. As a result, Chinese officials are not reaching farmers like Tang Weita. When one of his pigs suddenly died 3 months ago of the swine fever, he said he quickly slaughtered his other four dozen before they could fall sick as well, but he buried them and took a big loss rather than reporting the deaths to the government compensation. 3 years, of course, were all for nothing, Mr. Pang said. His loss was the government's as well, because he did not report the episode. Local officials could not make sure that he followed all the steps necessary to halt the spread, like burying carcasses a considerable distance from his farm. Mr. Pang said he probably buried them too close to his farm, but declined to discuss the details of that disposal. The epidemic shows the limits of China's emphasis on government-driven, top-down solutions to major problems, sometimes at the expense of the practical. It has also laid bare the struggle of a country of 1.4 billion people to feed itself. China has long viewed food security as tantamount to national security. It had become essentially self-reliant in pork as well as in rice and wheat thanks to subsidies and aggressive farmland management. The swine fever epidemic will test that commitment with its increasingly affluent people who more often expect meat at the dinner table. The pig disease, a highly contagious and untreatable outbreak that is not fatal to humans but can be spread by us, has now extended swiftly out of China. It has moved across 9 other Asian countries, particularly Vietnam, which is the world's 5th largest pork producer, and has lost much of its herd this autumn. Before reaching China, the disease had been slowly infesting occasional farms in Russia and elsewhere in Eastern Europe. Powered by pork, China's overall food prices last month were 1/5 higher than they were a year ago, after 7 years of very little change. Large purchases of pork by China are driving up live hog prices in the United States, Europe, and around the globe, pushing up costs for everything from German sausages to Vietnamese pork meatballs. I mean, drop for a second. Beef and lamb prices have risen as families worldwide seek alternatives, so much so that the overall meat prices in international commodity markets have increased nearly 20% in the past year. Brazil is now ramping up beef and chicken production to meet demand, partly by burning forests in the Amazon to clear land for the agricultural efforts. The epidemic could have brought in deep economic impacts at the global level, said Boubacar Ben Belhassen, the director of trade and markets at the United Nations Food and Agricultural Organization in Rome. We don't think there's enough pork in the world to offset China's shortfall. China used to have 440 million pigs, almost half the world's population, but its herd has shrunk by half or more, according to Rabobank, a Dutch bank with a heavy agricultural focus. Pork prices in China have more than doubled. The problem has become so pressing that Peking accepted a partial trade deal with the United States last month, in part to resume imports of American food. Pig prices have climbed so high that one livestock company printed red banners to recruit potential farmers that read, "Raise 10 sows and drive a BMW next year." Stopping the epidemic was always going to be tough. Small farms, often packed together in crowded agricultural areas, produce nearly half of China's pigs. To stop diseases from spreading, Chinese officials have to reach millions of traditional small farmers. China's leadership has focused on remaking farming to stop the spread with generous subsidies. Peking has ordered governments and businesses to build industrial-scale farms with safeguards like quarantine areas for new arrivals and incinerators for diseased pigs. That solution could help long-term, but China's immediate response may have made this spread even worse. Let me drop for a sec. When the swine fever began to spread 16 months ago, the Ministry of Agriculture told the country's local governments to cull all pigs and herds if there was even one sick animal and to compensate the farmers. The ministry authorized local governments to pay up to $115 for the largest pig, a cap later raised to $170. Before the epidemic, however, many pigs sold for $250 or more apiece, particularly breeding sows. According to government data, with the epidemic, the price has soared to $600 or more. To get to that partial reimbursement, many farmers had to deal with tight-fisted local officials. The ministry said it would reimburse local governments only for between 40% and 80% of their costs. Local governments also had to provide proof, more often including laboratory tests, that the pig died of African swine fever and not some other ailment. As a result, culling has been very slow. Official data shows only 1.2 million pigs, or less than 0.3% of the country's herd, has been culled. It's not clear where the rest of the country's vanished herd went to, but food experts say that many were likely butchered and turned into food. That would worsen the spread because the disease can lurk in meat for months. Australia has found that almost half of the sausages and other pork products carried by recently arriving passengers or the mail were contaminated, said Mark Shipp, a president of the 182-nation World Organization for Animal Health in Paris and Australia's chief veterinarian. In a quiet village, there is a low, pine-studded hill of northern Hunan province. A number of farmers said that they did not bother with seeking compensation, citing the low payout. Where many pigs went is a mystery. Mr. Peng, farmer, said that when he slaughtered his pigs, he had panicked and buried them in secrecy, and so had no record of what became of them. He filed for the loss under the commercial insurance, which covered only a tenth of the value of the pigs, he said. Let me drop for a sec. Chinese officials have tried to be reassuring. In April, July, and October, officials said they had brought the disease under control, only to see signs of further spread. Each new statement was provided by a less senior official than the one before. Most recently, the agricultural ministry said that it only hoped production at the end of next year would be 4/5 of normal level, still a shortfall equal to the entire pork production of the United States, the world's second largest pork-producing nation. For now, dying pigs and rising pork prices are changing diets and cooking practices across China. Su Dezi, a pork butcher at an open-air market about 20 miles from Mr. Chen's farm, said that he used to buy and carve up 2 pigs a day for sale. Now he can only sell half a pig a day. The wholesale prices per pound for him to buy pigs has more than tripled. Quote, "I can barely cover my costs," he said, a large cleaver in his hand as he stood behind a table with only a few bloody slabs of pork. Yet many in China seem reluctant to eat anything else. Across an aisle from Mr. Su stood several large cages full of chickens and ducks, but the poultry vendor said that his sales had only increased about 30%, 30 birds a day, or 33 to 34, partly because poultry prices also have risen. Those who have pigs have enjoyed these surging prices. A 36-year-old pig farmer with a black dragon tattoo on his right arm is among the few pig farmers in province who have not lost any pigs. He said he had cooked meals for his pigs from raw corn that year rather than buy feed that might be contaminated. Pigs have become so rare in his part of the Hunan province that when he drives to a village these days to sell an animal or two, he says he draws a crowd. People gather around the truck and stare at them, he says. They're like seeing pandas. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. It wouldn't be a proper science talk if I didn't include a report on some revolutionary battery technology that will be a game changer in the future. Electric vehicles may play an important role in reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but they are not yet a perfect solution. Today, most electronic vehicles run on lithium-ion batteries made with heavy metals like cobalt, of which there is a limited supply and a less than ideal mining conditions. The IBM Research Battery Lab may have a solution, a new battery built without heavy metals. It's made instead with materials that can be extracted, they say, from seawater. According to IBM, the new design could outperform current lithium-ion batteries in cost, changing charging time, they say less than 5 minutes to reach an 80% charge, power density, and energy efficiency. The battery is also less flammable and could be used in aircraft and smart energy grids, as well as electric cars and trucks. The battery uses three new proprietary materials, including a cobalt and nickel-free cathode material and a liquid electrolyte. The unique combination is able to suppress lithium metal dendrites during charging, which lowers the chances of the battery catching fire. To move the new battery beyond the IBM Research Battery Lab, the team has partnered with Mercedes-Benz battery electrolyte supplier, Central Glass, and battery manufacturer Sidus. While the team works out how to develop the battery, IBM Research will use artificial intelligence to further improve battery performance and search for even safer, higher-performing materials. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on to the next. Men are twice as likely to consider themselves to be good at lying and at getting away with it, according to new research. People who excel at lying are good talkers and tell more lies than others, usually to family, friends, romantic partners, and colleagues, according to the research led by Dr. Brianna Verrigan of the University of Portsmouth. Expert liars also prefer to lie face-to-face rather than via text messages and social media. Was the least likely place where they'd actually tell a lie. But Dr. Verrigan, who splits her time between the universities of Portsmouth and Maastricht in the Netherlands, said, "We found a significant link between expertise at lying and gender. men were more than twice as likely to consider themselves expert liars who got away with it. Previous research has shown that most people tell 1 to 2 lies a day. But that's not accurate. Most people don't lie every day, but a small number of prolific liars apparently are responsible for the majority of lies reported. But what stood out in their studies was that nearly half, about 40%, of all lies are told by a very small number of deceivers, and these people will lie with impunity to those closest to them. Quote, prolific liars rely on a great deal on being good with words, weaving their lies into truth, so it becomes hard for others to distinguish the difference, and they're also better than most at hiding their lies with apparently simple, clear stories which are harder for others to doubt, end quote. Dr. Berrigan quizzed 194 people, half of them men, half of them women, with an average age of about 39 years. They were asked a series of questions, including how good they were at deceiving others, how many lies they told in the past 24 hours, the type of lies they told, whether they'd done so face-to-face or via other means. She said, time after time, studies have shown that we are not as good at detecting lies as we think we are. At best, most of us have a 50-50 chance of getting it right when someone is pulling the wool over our eyes. Let me drop for a sec. We wanted to focus on those who were good at lying and try to understand how they do it and to whom. The study found one of the key strategies of liars is to tell plausible lies, to stay close to the truth, and to not give away much information. And the better someone thinks they are at lying, the more lies they tend to tell. The most commonly used strategy among all those who admitted to lying, whether experts or poor liars, was to leave out certain information. But expert liars added to that ability to weave a believable story embellished with truth, making the lies harder to spot. In contrast, those who thought they weren't good at lying resorted, when they did lie, to being very vague. Overall, the 194 people, of the 194 people, the most common types of deception in descending order were white lies, exaggeration, hiding information, burying lies in a torrent of truth, and just making things up. Most people chose to lie face-to-face and via text messages, a phone call, email, and last via social media. Most expert liars lie most often to family, friends, and colleagues. Employers and authority figures were least likely to be lied to. The study showed no link between the level of education and lying ability. Dr. Berrigan said more research needs to be done, particularly on better understanding good liars' expertise at embedding lies within truthful information and at using facts that were impossible to check. Let me drop for any questions or comments. This is AC2GS. Okay, on with the next. The first satellite designed to continuously monitor the planet for methane leaks made a startling discovery last year. A little-known gas well accident at an Ohio fracking site was, in fact, one of the largest methane leaks ever recorded in the United States. The findings by a Dutch-American team of scientists published this past Monday in the Proceedings of the National Academy of Sciences mark a step forward in using space technology to detect leaks of methane, a potent greenhouse gas that contributes to global warming from oil and gas sites worldwide. The scientists said that the new findings reinforce the view that methane releases like these are difficult to predict, would be far more widespread than previously thought. Quote, we're entering a new era. With a single observation, a single overpass, we're able to see plumes of methane coming from a large emission source, said Ilse Eben, an expert in satellite remote sensing and one of the authors of the new research. It's something totally new that we were previously not able to do from space. Scientists also said that the new findings reinforce the view that methane emissions from oil installations are far more widespread than previously thought. The blowout in February 2018 at a natural gas well run by ExxonMobil's subsidiary in Belmont County, Ohio, released more methane than the entire oil and gas industry of many nations do in a year. the research team found. The Ohio episode triggered about 100 residents within a one-mile radius to evacuate their homes while workers scrambled to plug the well. At the time, the Exxon subsidiary, XTO Energy, said it could not immediately determine how much gas had leaked, but the European Space Agency had just launched a satellite with a new monitoring instrument called Tripomi. It's designed to collect more accurate measurements of methane. We said, "We can see it. Let's look," said Steve Hamburg, a New York-based scientist with the Environmental Defense Fund, which had been collaborating on the satellite project with researchers at the Netherlands Institute for Space Research in Utrecht, in the Netherlands. Natural gas production has come under increased scrutiny because of the prevalence of leaks of methane, the colorless, odorless main components of natural gas from the fuel supply chain. Let me drop for a sec. When burned for electricity, natural gas is cleaner than coal, producing about half the carbon dioxide that coal does. But if methane escapes into the atmosphere before being burned, it can warm the planet more than 80 times as much as the same amount of carbon dioxide over a 20-year period. The satellite's measurements showed that in Ohio, in the 20 days it took for Exxon to plug that well, about 120 metric tons of methane an hour were released. This amounted to twice the rate of the largest known methane leak in the United States from an oil and gas storage facility in Alisa Canyon, California in 2015, though that event lasted longer and had higher emissions overall. The Ohio blowout released more methane than the reported emissions of the oil and gas industries of countries like Norway and France, the researchers estimated. Scientists said that the measurements from Ohio sites could mean that other larger leaks are going on undetected. Quote, "When I started working on methane now about a decade ago, the standard line was, we've got it under control, we're managing it," Dr. Hamburg said. But in fact, they didn't have the data. They didn't have it under control because they didn't understand what was actually happening, and you can't manage what you can't measure. An Exxon spokesman, Casey Norton, says that the company's own scientists had scrutinized images and taken pressure readings from the well to arrive at a smaller estimate of the emissions from the blowout. Exxon is in touch with the satellite researchers, Mr. Norton said, and has agreed to sit down and talk further to understand the discrepancies and see if there's anything that we can learn. "This was an anomaly," he said. "This is not something that happens on any regular basis, and we do our very best to prevent this from happening." An internal investigation found that high pressure had caused the well's casing or internal lining to fail. Mr. Norton said, after working with Ohio regulators on safety improvements, he said the well is now back in service. Let me drop for a sec.
Roy, did you say that methane is 880 times greater at creating global warming compared to carbon dioxide? Did you say 80? Go ahead.
Indeed, 80.
Okay. All of the digesting going on in the multiple stomach of a cow gives off a whole lot of methane. So all those cows giving off methane, and human beings also, that maybe the total methane impact on global warming from cows may be challenging the amount of carbon dioxide we're giving off with burning hydrocarbon fuels. Over you, Roy.
It's a good theory. I think I've read reports where the amounts are not quite as big as people tend to suggest otherwise. Unfortunately, that would probably not be very helpful for people who are deniers, because that would be yet another reason to suggest that inefficient use of resources to grow cows as opposed to grow corn and other things, should be performed. And as I've said earlier with the talk about the Chinese and pigs, human beings, for the most part, are, they like to think of themselves as carnivores. We're really omnivores. We eat everything. But we're not inherently vegetarians, and a strict vegetarian diet without food supplements can be problematic. So people are going to just keep eating cows and other animals. But, yeah, to a degree, there is a problem with methane production. We don't really produce that much methane ourselves. Most of the gas that we tend to pass tends to be swallowed nitrogen. It's not really that much of methane, but, you know, every bit hurts, as the saying goes.
Is there something different about the digestive system of a cow that he gives up more methane than a human being does when he digests his food? The fact that the cow is eating primarily grass, I guess, and with a couple of stomachs digesting it, does that create a greater amount of methane?
It's a different system. It basically requires the assistance of bacteria in its multiple stomachs in order to digest. Mammals are not able to digest directly cellulose, and that's most of the plant material that you see, other than fruits and roots and what have you, are basically biology. The plant's answer to plastics is cellulose. It's a polymer of sugar molecules, and mammals can't digest it, but bacteria can. Termites can't even digest wood. They again also use the same symbiotic relationship with bacteria that can digest cellulose and turn it into a usable form for them. So there's a lot more wasted organic material in the way that cows eat than other animals that have more efficient food sources.
Some of the foods that we eat do contain cellulose, I'm guessing. So that cellulose has to be digested by the bacteria in our stomach, is that what you're saying, Roy?
Basically, it runs through us. That's the old line about how fiber is good for you if it keeps you regular, because it stays in the same form. It might break down in the large structure, but the molecules themselves remain pretty much intact. We don't really absorb much in the way of nutrients from cellulose. Some plant cell material around it we can get something out of. But green leafy vegetables give you more fiber than anything else. Some vitamins, but mostly fiber.
So I think you're saying that human beings don't contain the right kind of bacteria that can digest the cellulose, but cows do, is what I think you're saying.
Yes, I mean, they have a much more, they have a much different GI tract. They have multiple stomachs. They can cycle the material back and forth. They can leave it for a longer period of time and thereby culture the proper bacteria and give the bacteria time to digest the cellulose. We don't have any of that. As I mentioned, we're primarily omnivores. We're kind of designed for a little bit of everything, including meat and such. Cows can't digest meat, and we would be really stuck if we just lived on grass. You'd basically die of starvation.
So I think you're saying the food passes through our GI tract so fast that the bacteria doesn't have a chance to do the fermenting and real digesting, and therefore the fiber that we eat, an awful lot of it stays as fiber as it goes through our system, is what I think you're saying, because we don't spend enough time. I guess it takes, in the case of a cow, maybe some of that grass is in his stomach for a couple of days. Is that what's going on, Roy?
It's a number of characteristics that cows have that we don't have, and because they have this this area that they can just kind of collect the chewed up food and not expose it to extreme acids that we do in our stomach lining, that they can have a much more significant bacterial colony in their stomach. For the most part, our bacteria in our body tends to be in the large intestine, which is past the point of most of our digestion and absorption. And because we don't have any kind of facility for an organism to really get much out of the cellulose that we eat, We don't tend to culture the type of bacteria that inherently are designed for breaking down cellulose. Our biome is somewhat different. There's a whole bunch of anaerobic bacteria that are designed for a different type of environment than a cow stomach.
To have a healthy diet, we're supposed to eat a certain amount of fiber every day. Is the majority of that fiber cellulose, or can the fiber be bran and other things like that? Maybe celery. Over to you, Roy, KTRIW.
Well, for the most part, the celery is cellulose. Most of the plant material that's non-digestible, non-absorbable, tends to be in the form of long chains of saccharide sugar molecules that are basically cellulose. There are some other non-absorbable materials that plants produce that can add bulk to the bowel movement and such, but we're kind of designed to work with non-nutritious bulk material in our system. If you just, you know, when I was a little kid, one of the major science fiction tropes was that people didn't eat food. They had these little pills of all the nutrients that they needed. And if you just took the nutrients with the calories and the vitamins, you probably would have a real bad GI problem because you wouldn't have the bulk that our GI tract is designed to work with. So that wouldn't work very well. So it supplies us with bulk. It doesn't really supply us with that much in the way of nutrition, but it helps us clean out our GI tract. It's a more of a maintenance type of substance than it is a nutrient.
During the early Apollo missions, they were feeding the astronauts low-fiber food so that there was less solid material that had to be disposed of. And although it gave them advantage in one area, I think it gave the astronauts an awful lot of constipation problems and whatever. So I think in the big picture, it didn't work out very well. I wonder if you remember some of those stories way back then, Roy, KTRIW.
Back in those days, I was getting most of my reading material from NASA that was mailing me all kinds of wonderful glossy stuff, and they completely breezed over the GI tract. But I could understand where, on the short haul, if you don't have to worry about the long haul, you're probably okay with constipating your poor astronaut. It's kind of a slippery slope. You certainly couldn't even address that issue on the ISS, because you'd have a lot of sick astronauts on your hands. But I could understand where some guys, when there's a very short window that they'll be up there, you could play games and experiment with their diets and see how people can tolerate these things.
But the six missions that went to the moon, the astronauts are out in space for a week and a half. Your system has to do an awful lot of digesting in that week and a half. You can't just wait until you get back home, if you know what I mean. Go ahead.
I mean, you don't need to be a rocket scientist to realize that you have to plan for things like that. I mean, the initial missions that were just up and down, and you didn't have to worry too much. They just put a diaper on these astronauts, and then, you know. But, you know, after a certain amount of time, you can't just diaper them. And you have to deal with that type of excrement management. It's not the nicest part of the job, but someone has to deal with it, because human beings do that. So, yeah, you have to plan ahead. You have to know what you're doing, and you have to be able to correct the problems when they come up there, which is probably very difficult. Because it's not like you could just Google and order something from Amazon. UPS doesn't go there.
It's not too difficult to picture what it was like in an Apollo command module. Three astronauts side by side, no separate bathroom facilities. And so taking care of solid waste in a weightless environment. Guarantee that was not a fun procedure. Over to you, KQRIW.
I get the sense that astronauts as a group were not the most shy individuals in the world.
You had to be pretty friendly with your other two fellow astronauts in a situation like that. Because, doesn't sound like fun.
But you have to look at the whole picture. These guys lived on adrenaline. I was talking to someone just today about them. You know, they were all test pilots in a previous life. And, you know, I mean, just the thought of some of the things that they did would scare the heck out of me. But these guys, you know, like cows live on cellulose, like we live on fruits and vegetables and meat. These guys, I think, lived on adrenaline. So, and some of the stories, you know, if you start to read a lot of the stories that kind of leaked around the edges of NASA, there were some crazy guys out there.
One of the better kept secrets is that of all the astronauts that go into space, roughly 50% of them spend the first 24 hours with seasickness, you could call it, and very uncomfortable, and no great solution for it. An astronaut might have two missions in space where he doesn't have them, and the third one he does. And Dramamine pills, I think, only gave you a partial correction of that. So going into space, roughly half human beings will develop some pretty serious seasickness for the first 24 hours. KQRIW.
Hey, you're right, Dick. And the problem, among other things, is you can't predict what you said. There are people who will go up there and nothing will happen. They'll go up a second time, nothing will happen. They go up the third time and something happens. So, you know, it's not like they can even highly predict or even vaguely predict. We're just not properly evolved for microgravity. We have a built-in balance system that requires a gravitational field for the labyrinth in our inner ear to tell us where we are in three-dimensional space. Sometimes we can deal with kind of somewhat shutting it off and using visual cues. But ultimately, there's enough problems with that you get a bad feedback mechanism and you get very, very dizzy. You know, we're just not evolved for this. Our species has been around for millions of years, evolving on a 1G gravitational field planet, and we've sort of optimized for that. To ask us to just kind of move to some other environment where there's little to no G-forces is asking a bit of technology, a bit of biology.
I think some of what the astronauts are told to do when they first get into the weightless environment is don't swing your head back and forth, left and right, and up and down very much for some time. The fluid in the semicircular canals that gives you orientation, if that gets shaken around in the microgravity environment, the human body can become very confused, and I think that's a strong contributing factor to some of the dizziness and space sickness. K2RIW.
I mean, there's two basic systems that tell us where we are in three dimensions. One is our visual cues. We look around and we see where we are. So sometimes if you confuse people that way, you have these virtual reality devices that were giving people nausea by sending the wrong optical signals. They would tell people that they were upside down visually. When their inner ear, the vestibular apparatus is the secondary system that purely works on gravity. There's three semicircular canals in each inner ear. They're at right angles to each other. There's a small calcium stone, and there are nerve sensors that can tell where the stone has settled. And based upon where the stone has settled, your brain kind of decodes it where you are in 3D space. And if you don't have gravity to have that little stone drop to the bottom of the gravity well, it could be any place and sending you all kinds of strange signals that you're upside down, right side up, or whatever. Anyway, on that note, it's coming up to 11 o'clock. So, as always, I want to thank those people who participated, and I certainly want to thank Dick for giving me the opportunity to do this, and hopefully I will have a slew of stories and come up with some kind of puzzler next week, if I can. But once again, I remind everyone that if you have any puzzlers, if you have any interesting little strange things that you were surprised at learning, and you would like to share it with me, and I could share it with the rest of the crew here. Or if you have any topics you'd like me to cover, or if you don't like what I said about something and you have some kind of reference material to kind of point me at, or if you have any mailbag questions for Dick, any technical questions and you can't get on the TechNet, or if there's anything that you want Paul in the Space Report to address or to look at. The email address, as always, is mailbag@ac2gs.com. Again, mailbag@ac2gs.com. And I'll have links to all these articles that I've talked about and such. It's on my website. Just point your web browser to roy.ac2gs.com. And you'll be able to click those links. And I would recommend that when you have time, to click the link for the visual illusions and for the microscopic motion films that won an award. They are very interesting. So, once again, thanks to everyone for participating, and I will turn it over to Dick so he can turn it over to Paul.
Good stuff, Roy. Thank you. Paul, how is Boeing doing with that spacecraft? My guess is you've got some nice pictures of it landing. Is that true? WS2N, K2RIW for the Space Report. You got it, Roy. I mean, Paul.
Okay, yeah, sure. NASA put out some pictures. And now you can find them on quite a few websites just by putting in Starliner, Boeing. And I'm sure at this time you'll get one picture right after the other and some information as well. And Roy, next week, if you get to the one story about ultrasound and lasers, that sounds like a good one. I know you had that eventually coming up. That must be some kind of weird contraption. So maybe you'll cover that one next week. Dick, the Starliner was launched Friday at 6:36 in the morning. I got up early to make sure I got to see that thing launch. What you have is NASA has really directed private companies to take over low Earth orbit launches. So you have right now really two companies trying to get to the International Space Station first from American ground. And you have SpaceX, and they're flying their Dragon. They're trying to send the crew up there before anybody else. And you have Boeing launching the Starliner. Let me drop it to WS2. All right. Last March, SpaceX successfully. But they just send an uncrewed vehicle, Dragon crew vehicle, up to the International Space Station. They had a dock. They opened the door. Crew from the inside of the station went inside, poked around, made sure everything was okay. Eventually, they closed the door, and that one came back and landed in the Pacific Ocean. So that was successful, and they're still developing their crew vehicle to the point where they could eventually launch astronauts to the space station. Coming up, no doubt, sometime this year. I guess, within maybe 4 or 5 months. But Boeing is trying to do the same thing. So they have the Starliner. And both vehicles are have the capability of sending up four people at one time. That won't happen for the first launch. When they do put a crew in there, you might have two or three people. But it was Boeing's turn to see if they can get the Starliner to launch from Florida and head up to the space station and do duplicate what NASA did back in March. You know, they wanted to have the crew open up the door, maybe get some Christmas packages out of there for the, you know, as gifts.